From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, we celebrate the music and the message of Bob Marley.
Africa, unite, 'cause we're moving right out of Babylon, and we're going to our father's land.
Yeah. Almost 21 years after his death, Robert Nesta Marley is still reggae music's most internationally towering figure. Not only did his sound affect a generation of pop music, but he also brought his Rastafarian-influenced political messages to the four corners of the world. Bob Marley was the voice of the poor.
Them belly full, but we hungry. A hungry mob is a hungry mob. Are in a fall, but it's anti-tough. A yacht, a yuck, but you'd not enough.
He gave a voice to the oppressed.
It's a poem that Peter is told. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right.
He spoke out strongly against war and colonialism.
Check out the real situation. Nation war against. Where did it all begin? When will it end?
And championed universal love for all people.
One love, one heart. Let's get together and feel all right. Hear the children crying. One love. Hear the children crying. One heart.
The musician Robert Palmer once said of Bob Marley that no one in rock and roll has left a musical legacy that matters more or one that matters in such fundamental ways. Bob Marley came from the Trenchtown ghettos of Kingston, Jamaica, and in his short life became a symbol of peace worldwide with his vision of one world, one love. Bob Marley sang of rebellion and resistance to oppression. He sang reggae anthems of artistic freedom, and always he sang to spiritual freedom. Tonight we talk about the political message of Bob Marley's music and how it sounds in today's world. Does the music of Bob Marley apply to today's dramas of terrorism, high-tech war, and corporate collapse? What would the soul of reggae have to say about the world in 2002? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now in the studio is Roger Steffens, reggae lecturer and archivist and author of World of Reggae, featuring Bob Marley treasures from Roger Steffens' Reggae Archives. Welcome and good evening, Roger Steffens.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's nice to be here with you.
Well, it's great to have you. And you've got our tabletop here just covered with Bob Marley albums, Bob Marley colors, Bob Marley paraphernalia.
You should see my house.
Well, good Lord, I'm in the red, orange, and green world of
red,
Jamaica.
Red, gold.
Okay,
green.
Gold. Let it be gold.
Yes, I.
But it is Marley and Jamaica all over.
Yes.
You've made a life of tracking, of studying, of collecting everything to do with Bob Marley. What hooked you on Bob Marley in the first place?
Oh boy, that perfect combination of exquisite, nuanced poetry and an irresistible beat set to the human heart at rest. And
The
essential beat of reggae music is the key to its mysterious hold on the whole world, even when people can't understand the language.
And what do you mean by that?
The rhythm of reggae is the beat of the healthy human heart at rest. So there is a visceral reaction for people when they hear the music, even if they don't understand the lyrics. And then the idea that reggae music is the essential protest music around the world, so that you've got a group in New Zealand called Herbs, which formed in the aftermath of Bob's visit there in 79, a group made up of Maori, Tongan, and Samoan Islanders who don't get along normally, who play protest music to a reggae beat. A group in Australia of Aboriginals called No Fixed Address, playing reggae music and singing in Aboriginal languages. Protest music. Gdańsk, Poland, people in the shipyard singing Polish protest music, wearing red, gold, and green outfits and playing a reggae rhythm.
We're going to listen to a lot of music tonight, but we want to listen to it with Bob Marley's politics in mind.
Mm.
Against the backdrop of September 11th and all the anger and violence that exploded there, mm-hmm. Peoples, nations, cultures even potentially opposed to one another, against all the talk coming from all corners of the world now about issues of rich and poor, about how globalization works, about whether or not it works to free folks or oppress folks. how we wish we could have Bob Marley at the table and hear what he had to say. But his music stands here, and we want to hear what's in there and see what resonates today. But give us a sense of how Bob Marley's politics were born. How were they forged?
Well, it's almost a contradiction in terms to talk about politics and Bob Marley, because he eschewed politics, at least on the surface. The essential beliefs of his Rastafari faith, Tom, decree that all governments on the face of this earth are illegal and every law is illegal except the law of Jehovah. And they believed that Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia was the living God incarnate on the planet in these times, fulfilling revelation in the Bible that when Christ returns to the earth, he will no longer return as the lamb to the slaughter, but in his kingly character of King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and conquering lion of the tribe of Judah. In 1930, Rastafari, a nobleman who could trace his lineage back to Solomon and Sheba, was crowned Haile Selassie,
King of Ethiopia,
Lord of Lords, conquering lion of the tribe of Judah. So people who had prophesied this for many years on the streets of Kingston said, this is the man we have been predicting to come and herald the final days and the return of his people to the mother continent of Africa. The day of deliverance is near now that Haile Selassie, which means literally light of the Trinity, has returned as a living God.
So here's Bob Marley, a British military father.
No, that's not true at all. That's been in
that's
a lot.
That's what all the bios
that's
say.
That's what all the bios say, and it's just horse pucky. His father was a white Jamaican. He was in his
50s. Military.
No, not
and
at all.
And not British.
No, no. White Jamaican who was born in the parish of Clarendon in Jamaica.
Okay.
And he was a kind of a plantation overseer during World War II because he was old. He wasn't able to be drafted into the war. And he got an 18-year-old black girl pregnant up in the hills of northern Jamaica. And at the age of 19, she gave birth to her son, Nesta Robert Marley.
Now, he's associated with Kingston, but you say he grew up, spent his early childhood in the countryside?
He lived in the country basically till he was about 14, 15 years of age, but there was a key element in his life that changed everything for him. His father never really saw him, but when he was about 5 years of age, the father sent a letter to Bob's mother up in the country and said, send the boy to me to Kingston. I'll educate him in a good school and give him a chance at life. The mother put him on a bus. The father picked the boy up and sent him to live with an old woman in the ghetto who was dying, abandoned him with this old woman.
Okay.
And he lived that way for a year and a half. Now, you can turn real bad real fast under those circumstances.
How did he make the connection to the Rastafarian movement?
That's much later. But the point I wanted to make there was that he developed an empathy for the suffering of people who, through no fault of their own, were thrust into this impoverished life. And that kind of empathy perhaps informed the politicized lyrics of his later work. Rasta came much later. Bob was already in his 20s. He was visiting in the summer of 1966, his mother, who had moved to Delaware, when Haile Selassie came to visit Jamaica at the request of the Jamaican government. The government paid for that trip because there were so many people worshiping as him as God that the government wanted him to come and say, hey, come on, guys, I'm not God.
I'm flesh and blood. I'm a man.
Well, Rasta elders who met with him claim that he told them, I am who you say I am. So he turned the tables
the
on the government.
Best laid plans of leaders.
Of government and men, yes.
And that echoed through Bob Marley's music forever. I want to listen to a cut from Exodus talking about damnation, about resurrection. Let's listen. Exodus. Bob Marley's Exodus. What are we hearing here? He's talking about we're getting out of Babylon, we're going to the promised land. Is this the voice of the poor Jamaican wanting liberation of some kind?
Not obvious? It's the voice of the impoverished earthling wanting deliverance. And what we're hearing here, Tom, Is Time Magazine's Millennium Issue Best Album of the 20th Century?
Yeah, they said...
title track.
A couple of years ago, they named it that.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Henry Luce must be turning over in his grave, right?
I doubt if it's the music that he went to bed listening to.
I don't think so, but Exodus is part of the rallying cry of the Rasta Nation.
It says Jah,
God, is Jehovah.
Come to break down oppression, rule equality, wipe away transgression, set the captives free. Who did Bob Marley have in mind when he sang those lyrics? I don't mean the God part. Well, I mean, who are the oppressed that he envisioned?
About every one of us on this planet who are in a downpressive system that makes it impossible for people to survive in most of the planet right now. People living in absolute poverty and just the most terrible social conditions. Bob Marley believed that all those governments were illegal and that we had to change people's heart. We had to repatriate both spiritually and physically. Exodus comes from Marcus Garvey, the great prophet of black repatriation.
Who had Jamaican.
He had a couple of million people in uniform in Harlem and other parts of the United States in the 1920s, and J. Edgar Hoover set him up to put a plant in his organization and threw him in jail and deported him from the country, and now he's a national hero and his picture is on the Jamaican money. You have Rasta and Marcus Garvey elements going into the movement of Jah people, the movement of repatriation forward home to Africa from which they have been stolen. And for a long time it was just a black thing. But with Marley's breakthrough internationally as a musician and as a social figure, you have a multiracial movement. And there were many people in the American government and the CIA who felt that Bob Marley in the 1970s was the most powerful black man alive.
We're going to come back and talk about that. I want to go into the break listening to Trenchtown Rock. Tell us about it.
That's his hometown. That's where he lived. It was built on a garbage dump, and there were the poorest of the poor people in there and some of the finest people on earth.
And he saw it ultimately as a source of spiritual inspiration.
It had to be, because you had no other kind of physical inspiration.
Well, Trenchtown Rock, Bob Marley.
Big fish are spreading.
Trenchtown Rock.
You reap what you sow.
Trenchtown Rock.
And only Jah Jah knows.
Trenchtown Rock.
I never turn my back.
We're coming up on a break, Roger Steffens, but tell us about Trenchtown and Trenchtown Rock.
Well, you know, that's the song he sang in front of 80,000 people two nights after the assassins came to murder him in 1976.
And why did they do that?
Nobody knows the real reason, but it had to do with the fact that he was suggesting that politics were not the solution out of Jamaica's problems, and people didn't want to see him perform at a free concert in Jamaica and threatened his life, and in fact, some of the people closest to him were almost murdered that night. His wife was shot in the head, and his manager was shot five times in the groin, and he was shot in the chest and arm, and still went on to perform two nights later at this phenomenal event called the Smile Jamaica Concert, singing this song and others.
Did Bob Marley see himself as a revolutionary?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm a rebel, he said with a sneer in his
voice.
And did
he mean, pick up the gun, that kind of revolution?
He wanted to burn and loot illusions, not physical things. He was interested in a spiritual revolution, not necessarily with guns and bullets. Rasta is not aggressive, but Rasta will defend itself.
Ah, to burn and loot illusions.
You
get away with that. Bob Marley's clearly gotten into your blood. We're talking with Roger Steffens about the legacy of Bob Marley. Tonight we're talking specifically about his political views and legacy. He was a spiritual guy, but it turned to politics quickly. You can join our conversation. What would Bob Marley say about this old world today? Where is the one love in a world torn by terror and war? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the music and politics of Bob Marley. Here's his song, Zimbabwe.
Every man got the right to decide his own destiny. And in this judgment, there is no partiality. So arm in arms with arms, we'll fight this little struggle. That's the only way we can overcome a little trouble. Brother, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're so right. We gon' fight,
we gon' fight,
we'll have to fight,
we gon' fight,
we gonna fight,
we gon' fight,
fight for our rights. Not the traded dinner,
Zimbabwe,
pretty dog.
Bob Marley singing in Zimbabwe, we'll have to fight for our rights. We're talking about the politics of Bob Marley and his music tonight with Roger Steffens. He's an unbelievable archivist and collector, student of Bob Marley and all that he did and all that he stood for. You can join the conversation as well. Where is the one love in a world torn by terror and war? And what about those oppressed that Bob Marley sings of? Who's singing for them today? What do you hear Bob Marley saying? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Roger Steffens, here he's singing in Zimbabwe, very specific lyrics, saying, yeah, we will have to fight.
Yeah.
What was the setting, and what was the call that he was giving?
This is a song he did for his most militant album in 1979, when Rhodesia was still fighting for its freedom from British colonial rule.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a song that gave great sustenance to the freedom fighters in Rhodesia. And when Rhodesia became independent on April 17, 1980, Bob Marley was the only foreign figure invited to attend the independence celebration and headline the independence festivities.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
And the first words spoken in the independent nation of Zimbabwe were, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Marley and the Wailers singing that song. Can you imagine the electrifying moment that must have been?
I'm sure it was. Bob Marley talks here about fighting. We'll have to fight. He also talks a lot about judgment in this song and many songs.
Yes.
What's the judgment that he's referring to here?
The judgment is Jah's. Only God has a right to make a judgment. But he is saying from his vantage point as one of the sufferers that there is going to be a final and fearful judgment on the part of Jah. And you make a very good point, especially with the choice of your music. At the end of the Trenchtown Rock song is a verse that was left off the original release where he says, don't call no cops. Got no stocks on the shelves. We can trash things ourselves. And sometimes the patois in which he spoke made it sound like something different from what he meant. Trash meant thrash, as if we can thrash these problems out ourselves here in Trenchtown. We don't need the cops or any outsiders coming in
to force their way on us. He didn't mean rioting.
No, not at all. That's how it's pronounced in Jamaica, thrash, like three is tree. They drop the H.
But boy, if you were chief of police in a lot of cities, in poor cities around this world, those lyrics would have had you sitting on the edge of your chair if they were booming through your neighborhoods.
And it did. It rightfully scared those who deserved to be frightened.
It was a rich and poor divide world, even in Bob Marley's time.
Terribly so.
Of course, it's become no less. I mean, we have,
it's
3 billion now living below the poverty line around the world. What do you think Bob Marley would have made of the progress of history since his death in 1981?
Well, it's a question many of us in the reggae community have asked, because he had such a profound effect in so many different areas, not only fashion-wise and music-wise, but morally and spiritually. Jack Healy, the president of Amnesty International, has said that everywhere he goes in the world today, Bob Marley is the symbol of freedom. And, of course, after Bob died, the right-wing government took over in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. The music turned slack almost immediately, slack meaning filled with songs that promoted violence and gunplay and homophobia and misogyny and all the things that Bob would never permit his songs to do. And had Bob stayed alive, I think we would have had a very different condition in Jamaica and a very different world. He was filling stadiums in the summer of 1980. He played Milan in 1980 in a stadium where the Pope had appeared before, the week before, and he outdrew the Pope. In Italy.
But we have this sense sometimes of Bob Marley as, in his time, And I heard what you say about Zimbabwe, but yet sometimes the sense that he was very popular in the white Western affluent world and not necessarily as popular in the black American world or the third world.
That was a tragedy for Bob because his greatest goal of all was to be number one on the R&B charts and to reach his rightful people because he identified primarily as a black person. And
a lot of
black stations didn't even play his music until the day he died on May 11th.
Because
he was talking about getting up and standing up in American music in those days. Black music was talking about get down, and Peter Tosh and Bob Marley were talking about upliftment and upfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a slower beat, and a lot of music in the 70s was informed by a cocaine mentality and that kind of rhythm like cell doors clanging over and over, put your teeth on edge.
Yeah.
This was a laid-back music where you rented a tile in a dance hall and did the all-night skank, and you just meditated between yourself and Jah, the I and I meditation. Mm-hmm. Wasn't you and me in Jamaican Talk. So there's a whole world, a whole universe of thinking differently about life on Earth for them. If we were talking now to Bob Marley, he wouldn't say you. He would say yes, I, if you asked him a question. Because you is separation, and that's devilism. It's the original book of the Bible talking about the old dragon of separation.
And so, yes, I means you and I are one. We are...
Sure. I and I is you and I. Mm-hmm. I and I is God in me. We are all manifestations of the one true and living God.
So the wordplay isn't just to be funky.
It's
or
not
cool.
Wordplay. It's totally thought out. And
it's theology.
They don't go to university. They go to university. And they don't study in the library because lies lie buried in the library. They go to the true-brary. Language has an evocative effect for Rasta. It is literally the power of creation. The trinity they talk about of word, sound, power.
Mm-hmm.
You conceive the word, you sound it, and that is literally the power of creation if it comes from a pure heart.
Ah, this is music to a radio man's heart.
Yeah, man.
They have
a conception. Weak heart conception half a drop. It means
translation.
A weak heart is somebody somebody coming from a false place, an untrue stance, and whatever that person says, his creation is bound to die. Weak heart conception, half a drop. It's only the true heart that creates for Ivor.
We're trying to come from a strong heart, from a true heart.
So you see, this is revolutionary. It may not be political, but it changes the world when you think that way. And that's what Bob espoused.
It's a centimeter away from politics, and the next second, it's right in the middle of it.
Absolutely.
We're talking
and
about,
he got forced into it too, and almost killed because of it.
Yeah. We're talking about Bob Marley's music tonight and the politics that just run all through them, politics that we have to find some resonance in today with the world struggling with poverty and wealth side by side, all mixed up together. We're talking with Roger Stevens. He's followed Bob Marley for many, many years now. 30 years. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Zahan is on the line. Welcome, Zahan. You're on the air.
Thank you. Just a brief word of thanks. I think this is an extremely timely occasion to present this message. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
You're welcome, Zahan.
That you're airing this. My comment was this. I think part of the relevance of Bob Marley's message today was how incredibly rooted in history Bob Marley was in his time and how aware of that the plight of his people were so linked to those before him. And I think of the song... Crazy Bald Heads, in which he sings, didn't my people before me slave for this country?
Yeah.
And I think that today his message is the same and would be the same for us as we consider the plight of those that are oppressed, both within and without the confines of this country.
Zahan, what do you think Bob Marley would have to say about this old world right now?
Well, I think Bob Marley would sing out loud and clear that... we are involved in a war that is based in the hypocrisy of our past, and that as a consequence of the way in which we've treated our neighbors, we're now tied back into war because essentially because of that treatment, because of that lack of love and unity that we've reserved for ourselves.
Roger Stephens, what do you think?
I think Zahan makes a very good point, too, and you hit the nail on the head quoting that poetry of him. Bob had this incredible gift of being able to reduce to its essential element horrors of capitalism. For example, he wrote, "Good God, this illiteracy is just machine to make money. You know, keep them stupid. Mm-hmm. You can pay them 17 mm-hmm. cents an hour mm-hmm. to make Nikes down mm-hmm. in Indonesia, you know. Mm-hmm. So he saw the essence of things, said it in a beautifully simple way that was so simple it was elegant and eloquent, and in so doing became a prophet illuminating our current situation to us, and also providing a way out, which is faith in God and love of your fellow human beings.
Zahan, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you for calling.
Let's hear some more music from Bob Marley. Let's listen to a bit of Ja Live.
Bless my eyes this morning. Ja sun is on the rise once again. We heard the things are going.
In the way of the world, that wasn't Ja Live. That was So Much Trouble in the World, and maybe that's even more appropriate to what Zahan was just raising, Roger Stephens.
The line in there is we're sitting on a time bomb. It's coming on strong. He saw these final days. He literally believed these were the last days. These were the days of the fulfillment of prophecy.
So he was into the Revelations line of the Bible.
Without question. And there's a very interesting version of this song by a young Chinese man named Terry Lin that was recorded with Bob's former partner, Bunny Whaler, and a video made which shows scenes of the young man in Tiananmen Square facing mm-hmm. off the tank mm-hmm. to the tune of Bob Marley singing So Much Trouble in the World. Unfortunately, Bob Marley's music is more relevant in the year 2002 than it ever was even during his own lifetime.
Why do you say that?
Because times have gotten worse, not better, and his music talked about that.
In what dimension?
Every dimension. As you said yourself, the inequality between the inequities between the rich and the poor, the fact that maybe 95% of the wealth in this country is owned by 1% of the people. These are things that create chaos and civil war and mass destruction. In one of the songs you played at the opening of the show, Tom, Real Situation, mm-hmm. Bob sang, it seems like total destruction is the only solution.
Now that's apocalyptic.
And that was one of the last songs he ever wrote.
And yet we've had the most apocalyptic images you could ask for in recent months.
More than anybody even believed possible.
Well,
right in front of us. And Bob saw all that.
Well, and now that the total trauma of its past, we feel the need to go to philosophers, to musicians, to try and dig a little deeper beneath our first responses and find out what's going on.
Yeah, but in ancient times, the philosophers were musicians. The greatest thinkers of ancient times were all musicians.
Well, we won't keep Bob Marley away from that definition. We're at 1-800-423-8255 talking about Bob Marley. Susan is on the line. Welcome, Susan. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I just wanted to call because earlier in the show, your guest had talked about how Bob Marley had no real respect for government, that he felt there was a higher authority. And I have an example of that in my own life. I was fortunate enough to see him play.
Where was that, Susan?
At Brown University in Providence.
Okay.
In March of 1981, 2 months before he died.
No, that was 1980 in September, and that was 8 months before he died. It was the fourth show from the end of his life.
Susan, our archivist is setting our live straight. I can't remember 20 years ago either, but tell us about the show.
Well, the greatest thing that happened at this show was he also didn't seem to have much admiration for concert promoters because the show had been sold as, floor seating was more expensive, et cetera. And what he had people do as soon as the concert started, within two or three songs, he had people calmly take all the chairs off the floor and invited everyone down from the stadium onto the dance floor.
He wasn't going to play by anybody's rules.
No.
Exactly. And it was just a lovely experience, and I wanted to share that with you and your listeners.
Wow. Susan, thanks so much for calling in.
Yeah.
Do you remember? What it was the September, so it was indoor. Do you remember the song, any song from that night, Susan?
I don't remember exactly which songs he played. I want to say he played a lot of stuff from Exodus.
And that was the Uprising tour also, Susan. So he's playing things like Work and Coming In from the mm-hmm. Cold, which were prophecies of his final days.
Yeah,
Susan, you're right. My memory for 2021
faded. But you're awfully lucky to have seen that history.
And the impression clearly stays. Susan, thanks so much for calling in with the memory.
One love.
Roger Stephens, what about Bob Marley's final days? He knew that he was going. He had cancer. What were his thoughts as he approached that end?
I think those thoughts can be seen in a song that was just released after being in the can for over 20 years called I Know a Place Where We Can Carry On, because his songs were like his daily diaries. And in this one, it's after he knows he has melanoma cancer, which was first diagnosed in 1977. Mm-hmm. And he sings, when the whole world lets you down and there's nowhere for you to turn and all of your best friends have let you down, when you try to accumulate, but the world is so filled with hate, I know a place where we can carry on. He saw his own death. When he was 24, he was living in Delaware in the Woodstock summer of 1969. Mm-hmm. He was 24 years old, and he told two men in Delaware that he was going to die at 36. And 12 years later, he did.
In his song, Ja Live, which we tried to get to earlier, we'll get to it now, but he said, essentially, you can take away a leader, but we will keep on. You can't kill God.
You can't kill God. It's an immortal spirit.
Bob Marley with Ja Live. Let's listen.
But not a sin.
Roger Steffens, what's the message here in Ja Live?
Never give up the fight, never give up the faith. No matter how much Babylonian hypocrisy and propaganda is out there, God is an eternal, immortal spirit and can never be wiped off the face of the earth. And that God is a living spirit. We only have to find where he is in our own hearts to make that happen.
Who was Bob Marley's mentor?
Ja, that's all. It was the father he never had. His father was Ja, and he sang to children all the time, but it wasn't to kids, because we're all children of God. So, Ja Live, children. You and I are those children. No matter how old we are those children he's singing to.
There's this powerful sense of the one love.
Without question.
It reaches across lines. It reaches across borders in the way that not too many things do these days.
Yeah. And the irony, Tom, is that he was prejudiced against by both black and white people. The white people looked at him as a little half-caste boy, and the black people rejected him because he had a white father. And then he became this incredible symbol of black consciousness around the world. It must have been a little difficult for Bob to relate to that at times.
Must have been, but we're looking back tonight and wanting to hear what Bob Marley has to say. What would Bob Marley say about this old world today? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
It shall be dread, a dread. Shall live children, yeah. Shall live children, yeah. Shall live children, yeah. Shall live children.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the music and the message of Bob Marley. Let's listen to one of his most famous songs, Redemption Song.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs.
Bob Marley singing his redemption song from the CD Uprising. It's been used many times by many people who've been oppressed or identified with the oppressed, like a final statement in his career, in a way, a summation of all themes and thought that created it.
Oh, utterly without question. It was the last song of his last album. In an album filled with prophetic songs, Zion Train is coming my way to take me back to Zion. Coming in from the cold, we and them, you know how we and them ago work things out. And redemption songs, all I've ever had are these songs of freedom. But those songs were created from the pure heart, and they will live forever. And an example of that I think you might find interesting, Tom. Mm. The New York Times, you know, decided to build a time capsule to be opened in the year 3000.
Okay.
And they had to pick one video that epitomized the finest musical moments of the 20th century. Mm. And they chose Bob Marley live at the Rainbow Theater in London in 1977 to be that video that will be seen 1,000 years from now.
1,000 years from now.
God willing.
What's the year 2525? We're
you and Zager and Evans.
Lucky to get there sometimes. George is on the line. Welcome, George. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Roger, I have two questions for you. One is, in order to bring about this brotherhood on Earth, which political economic system do you think Bob Marley would have preferred to do so? Mm. And secondly, with regard to his broad appeal, do you think the religious aspects of it limit his broad appeal and his message of brotherhood?
George, great questions. Roger Steffens.
Well, I think he was a communarian. He certainly was in his own lifestyle. He didn't even have a house of his own. He probably bought 30 or 40 houses for friends and band mm-hmm. members and family. He most often, you know, slept on the ground, slept on a cot, didn't even have a bed till the last 18 months of his life. And he was a multimillionaire. He was a communard. I think Bob would have gone back, or forward rather, to Ethiopia and established a community for Rasta that wanted to repatriate to Ethiopia. Eventually, with all his riches, he would have helped build an infrastructure of hospitals and schools and so forth, and that would have turned into Selassie City, maybe,
but
or
that's
Marleyville.
So uniquely Bob Marley. You can hear George here looking for some larger guidance. Is there a larger message about a global political system, or is Bob Marley just not going to prescribe?
It was up to each of us in our own heart of hearts to find the love among all humanity and solve it without weapons and without resort to atomic bombs, that truly in a Gandhi-esque spirit, Bob was asking for an end to violence, because Rasta does not believe in violence. A true Rasta, for example, up in the hills, won't even pull a pear off the tree. He'll only eat it when it falls to the ground itself. He won't interfere in the process.
But yet Bob Marley talked about fight. Stand up. Fight.
You stand up for your rights. You don't get pushed around. You defend yourself, but there is no aggression involved whatsoever.
Adam is on the line. Welcome, Adam. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. You know, that very first few words that George was saying is actually correct. I've seen a few Rasta guys who are totally not violent, but would stand for their rights. My question is, there's one song that amazes me when I hear it, and there's a line where he says, "Some are leaves, some are branches, but I and I are the roots."
Yes.
And I just wanted to know the meaning of those lines. Is he talking about, you know, the father of the earth, the human revolution, you know, starting from the continent of Africa? Is he talking about black men? Is he talking about something different?
Let's dive in and figure it out, Adam. What song, what line?
It's called Roots. It was the flip side of a single in 1976 and then released posthumously on an album called Rebel Music. And it was one of the true statements. Al Anderson, his American guitarist, said he was amazed to watch Bob write that song, because he was just writing about everything that was going on around him in Kingston at that moment. The Roots are the, you know, native peoples all over the world revere Bob Marley, people of the earth, the First Nations of Canada, the American Indians. I've done my Bob Marley video lectures in the bottom of the Grand Canyon to the Havasupai and to the Hopi. Mm-hmm. And he's a hero to those kinds of people, to the Maori, to the Aboriginal people, because those are people who understand the rhythm of the earth. Bob sang in one of his songs, "Cold ground was my bed last night and rock stone was my pillow." And that was literally true. Mm-hmm. He was most happy lying on a mountainside in the north of Jamaica, looking at the stars above his head and communing with the spirits and the rhythms of nature. And those are the Roots people.
Roger Steffens, our time is running down, and I'm sorry for it, because we could go and go, but did Bob Marley believe we could work our way to a better life in this life, or was it in the next?
There is no next life. It's only this life. Heaven is to be achieved here on planet Earth. There's no pie in the sky. There's not the Christian world where you have to die and go to heaven in Jesus' name, as he sang in one of his songs. It can be experienced here on Earth. We can live in eternal peace with God in us.
But we're going to go out listening to Rat Race.
Yeah, and that's the song that was banned in 76 by the government. Rasta, no work for no CIA, and the government told him to take it out of the stores. He was fomenting trouble during the state of emergency when the city was exploding around him.
Oh, Roger Steffens, our time is running out, and I regret it. I could go all night. You're a great collector. I see in your books and in your material you've got such an amazing wealth. Your collection is turning into Jamaica's national collection on Bob Marley.
Amazingly so. My wife and I were brought down to Jamaica in October to participate in a Peter Tosh symposium at the University of the West Indies, and during that time, the Jamaican government met with me and decided that they were going to acquire my archives and make them the National Museum of Jamaican Music.
It's amazing. Roger Steffens is author of World of Reggae, featuring Bob Marley treasures from Roger Steffens' reggae archives. Check out his website, Ras Roja.
Actually, it's my email address if people want to get in touch and have any questions.
RASROJAH at AOL.com. Roger, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Tom. Boy, that flew by, didn't it?
It sure did fly by.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, and good night. In a moment, I'm going to be joined by our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. But first, sounds from this past week.
This is on the way, and it is good.
You got it.
It's good. It's good. And the Patriots win Super Bowl 36 on an Adam Vinatieri.
How do you let this happen, Captain? I mean, your ship is going to go down, and you're going to be lashed to the mast unless you start talking to us about what happened.
We are still getting facts. You want me to give you conclusions without all the facts?
This afternoon, a grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia returned a 10-count indictment against Walker Lynn.
If one thinks about the economic loss that took place on September 11th, in this country and elsewhere in the world, in billions and billions of dollars, it is very clear that the defense budget is cheap when one compares it to putting our security at risk.
If you were in the private sector and proposed a budget like this one, you'd be headed for a federal facility. But it wouldn't be the White House. It wouldn't be the Congress of the United States. You'd be headed for a federal correctional facility.
Things that happen a long way away, whose causes are thousands of miles distant from our country, today have an impact on the economy and on the streets in our own country.
I assured the Prime Minister that we would continue to keep pressure on Mr. Arafat to convince him that he must take serious, concrete, real steps to reduce terrorist activity.
The flame that is lit tonight is not like any other. It is not the fire of destruction, but a light in the darkness.
A week framed by Super Bowl and Olympics, and in the middle, Enron, Arthur Anderson, CEO in the hot seat, John Ashcroft coming down on John Walker Lynn, Don Rumsfeld defending George Bush's huge defense budget increase, a Democratic senator from South Dakota saying, are you crazy? Tony Blair on African tour pledging support for that troubled continent, and President Bush talking about his meeting with Ariel Sharon. Jack Beatty, there's a lot going on in this sports sandwich.
Yeah, there is, and for we New England Patriots fans, quite a week. Through a friend of mine, Tom Kenny, I attended the first year of the Patriots games in 1960 at Old Braves Field,
And, Jack, you are an old curmudgeon then.
I am an old curmudgeon. And it, but, you know, it's opened up the cruelest item in Pandora's little box for we Red Sox fans. Now the fangs of hope are at it.
Yeah, good luck. But Jack, once the cheering was over in New England and the crying along the Mississippi, we were right back in this swirl. The huge budget numbers, the big hot seat waiting for everybody Enron connected on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, how thoughtful of the founding fathers to have included a Fifth Amendment, huh? Weren't they far-sighted?
Yes, they were something that anyone could take.
Anybody could take it, even these rogues. And, you know, this is it's interesting, the consistency of the pattern of conflict of interest. Not only did they use it against the politicians, the auditors, the board, they also used it within the company. With a treasurer who objected to some of these partnerships was replaced. A new guy was put in his place, and he was cut in on the deal. He invested $5,800 in one of these partnerships. 2 months later, they gave him $1 million.
But then we had CEO Skilling, ex-CEO Skilling of Enron, sitting in the hot seat saying, hey, I did nothing wrong. I saw nothing wrong. I was out of the room when the bad stuff went down. The power went off. I didn't see it.
Yeah, this is Mr. Detail. Suddenly, he doesn't know anything that's happening. Although there are contemporaneous witnesses who say, we told him this. He said, well, I don't remember that. What a performance. What a week. Yeah, the budget. That's the part of the week that's going to be we're going to be living with for the rest of the year. $2.1 trillion budget.
Well, and really for decades, perhaps.
For decades, indeed. $500 billion, it turns out, in Social Security funds will be tapped for other programs over the next 10 years. Say goodbye to your retirement, Tom.
I'd rather not.
There will be a $300 billion less for Medicare than the Congressional Budget Office says is needed to maintain current benefits. New York City promised $20 billion in aid. It looks like it's only going to get half of that, even though Mr. Bush has now reiterated his promise. But the budget says no more money for New York. The budget includes $100 million for military aid to the Philippines, where it turns out the Abu Sayyaf terrorists are 60 crooks on one island.
Well, we knew that all along, and I've been amazed at the way the media have picked up the al-Qaeda tag and just blithely, at the Pentagon's wish, tacked it onto the end of Abu Sayyaf. What a slight connection.
It's amazing, and even the president of Arroyo of the Philippines says to the New York Times, well, maybe they don't have a tie with the terrorist gangs, but they spread terror. So $100 million to the Philippines. The budget is going to cut money for Labor Department regulatory action. No more money for the SEC, but lots of money for a big Bertha howitzer made by a well-connected company, part of the $48 billion in mostly Cold War-era weaponry.
Jack, is campaign finance reform going to turn around this kind of trend?
We don't know. A development yesterday, that Speaker Hastert, who's dead against it, met with the President Bush, and he's trying to get the President to help him kill it. And the President is contemplating that now to see if they can get some amendments in that bill that will poison it.
But George Bush said he would not veto it if it came to his desk.
He will not veto it, and if they can get, and so it'll be interesting to see what the President now does.
Jack, have a great weekend off in Slalom Olympic land.
And to you too.
Thanks. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian, Tim Munro, and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're on Point.